So my guest today is David Gunkel. David is a professor of communication studies at Northern Illinois University. He is a leading scholar in the philosophy of technology, having written extensively about cyborgification, robot rights and responsibilities, remix cultures, new political structures in the information age, and much more. He is the author of several books, including Hacking Cyberspace, The Machine Question, and Of Remixology. And I found David's work to be enormously beneficial in my own research and writing, so I'm really looking forward to talking to him today. So yeah, anyway, I'd just like to welcome you to the show, David.
Thank you, John. It's wonderful to talk to you. I discovered your work only recently, I think when you quoted something that I had written, and as a result, I've learned more about what you do and the kinds of research that you're engaged in, and I think we got a lot to talk about.
Yeah, no, I think so too. So we probably share many interests, but let's try and keep relatively focused today. And I thought we'd talk about two main topics, which are definitely overlapped and shared areas of interest, which is the creation of autonomous robots and the implications that this has for society, and in particular for the rights and responsibilities of robots. And then also we'll talk about the phenomenon of cyborgification. I'll try and struggle my way through that word several times today, and the threat that it poses to traditional kind of humanist philosophies. Now, I mean, both of these things touch upon kind of two key themes of this project that I'm doing, which has to do with the way in which technology creates new governance structures. So I think robots are an obvious expression or modality through which new governance structures will be created. And also the way in which technology creates new governance subjects. So there's the cyborg subject and also the robot subject, which is something I know you've written and thought about a great deal. All right. So
correct.
Let's break up the conversation into those two main topics. And let's start with robots and robots' rights and responsibilities. And I'd just like to open this with two stories which have been in the news in recent days. And we can talk about your opinion on them later, but I just want to use these to kind of set up the conversation. One is this story from, I think it was last week, the shootings of the police officers in Dallas in Texas, and the hunting down of one of the suspects to this shooting. And I think Micah Johnson was the name of the
correct
man in question. So the police used a bomb robot to kill this suspect. And this has been widely reported and debated in the media, and people are talking about this being an unprecedented and important kind of new way in which robots are being used to administer lethal force in domestic police contexts. I mean, I guess equivalent kind of systems have been used in international warfare for some time. The other thing that I thought would just set the stage for this conversation is a recent report by the Legal Affairs Committee of the EU Parliament about advances in robotics and the implications this has for traditional legal standards of liability in criminal and civil contexts, and the need to create kind of new legal rules to address the gaps that arise because of the advances of robots. And one of the interesting things in that report was the claim that robots should perhaps be granted a type of legal personhood and have rights and responsibilities. And this story actually took on a bizarre kind of shape in this neck of the woods just before the Brexit vote. So I think this report came out at the end of May, but just prior to the 23rd of June when the EU referendum was taking place in the UK, a number of UK newspapers picked up on this report. And I think a lot of them were using it as kind of like, look at these crazy Europeans and their desire to turn machines into persons.
Right.
But I'm curious to see what your opinion is. I obviously read some of your work on it, but you don't think this is crazy at all. And you've been talking about this actually for a very, very long time.
Right.
So yeah, let's kind of explore the implications of this, because it's all talking here to the rise of the robots and the important kind of philosophical and social consequences of the rise of the robots.
Right. So let me, I guess, set the stage by parsing this a little more carefully than we normally do when we talk about these things, because we throw around the word robot and rights and responsibility all kind of in general terms without really getting specific about what this might mean or how. So the first thing I want to divide up is we have really two different kinds of machines that we have in mind when we talk about robots. There are the kinds of robots like the bomb robot that was used in Dallas, which was actually under the control of a human operator. It's kind of a drone more than it's a robot, like the drones that fly over Iraq and Afghanistan. And these are not autonomous machines, right? These are machines that are remotely controlled by generally more than one human operator. There's a commander and an operator and a weapons specialist, etc. But these devices are extensions of human control into a device. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, there are autonomous machines, right? Machines that are set up to do things without direct human control. I think the best example of this kind of machine is the Tay AI, which Microsoft released on the world, earlier this summer, with built-in learning algorithms that were used in order for Tay to learn how to behave like a teenager on Twitter. Well, unfortunately, people taught her very bad behavior. She became a racist, a lunatic in a very short period of time. But you know, she was not under the direct control of an engineer or a human operator. So we have autonomous machines on the one hand, and we have machines that are kind of human hybrid devices on the other. And that's one separation I would want to make. The other separation I would want to make is a separation between moral agency and moral patiency. Moral agency is the ability to do action in the world and take responsibility for that action. The word responsibility, therefore, attaches itself to the question of agency. Most of the work that's been done on AI and robotics with regards to the moral questions and even the legal questions generally move in the direction of agency. How can we trust whether the machines will treat us well? How can we trust whether a decision made by a robot will be an appropriate decision or not, as you know, depending on the situation? The flip side of that is patiency, moral patiency. Patiency has to do with who is a holder of rights. To whom do we owe responsibilities? In moral philosophy, there is a very easy way to separate this out. Human beings are usually considered to have both agency and patiency. That is, we can do right and wrong, and we can be either benefited or harmed by what others do. We can be either an agent or a patient. Animal rights philosophy sort of separates these and says, you know, animals may not be responsible for what they do, but they do have status. They do have a position in the world that requires us to treat them in ways that is not cruel, that is not inhumane. So they are moral patients without being moral agents. And so the question of the robot and the question of the machine is it just a moral agent? Is it both a moral agent and a moral patient? Or is it like an animal, just a moral patient? And if you look at the literature on this subject, you see different writers lining up on different sides of this debate, the agency debate, the patiency debate, or some hybrid of the two. And that's where I think the really interesting conversations occur, but it's also where I think a lot of the confusions can happen.
Yeah, I would like to just add in one further kind of distinction or qualification to that framework which you've laid out, which I think is very useful. But one thing as well to think about is that particular entities or beings can pass through different stages of agency and patiency over the course, yes, of their lifespan. So I mean, this is pretty intuitive in the case of human beings, because we would typically say that a child is a moral patient. We definitely owe duties to the child, and it's an object of moral concern. But we usually don't claim that children are moral agents. They don't have rights and responsibilities towards others, at least not in the same way that adults do. And I just kind of throwing this out there, could this be true as well for robots insofar as there could be different contexts in which we view them as agents and patients? I don't know if that's something you've ever, yes, thought about.
No, definitely. There are situations in which I think being able to divide up the moral question into agency and patiency can be very useful and very helpful. So when you're talking about the use of a robot, as they did in Dallas, in order to enact some sort of action in the world, there are questions having to do with responsibility and agency with regards to that device. To take it in a different direction, if you have a drone and the drone takes out the wrong target, you kill civilians, the question then becomes, who's responsible for the wrongful death of those civilian casualties? And there are ways in which these technological affordances can complicate the assignment of agency and make it very difficult to decide who actually is responsible for something having gone wrong. On the other hand, when you start to look at a world in which we are increasingly bringing robots into our domestic life. The very simple example is Siri, which we talk to, but there are much more advanced versions of this, like the Jibo social robot and other devices like Pepper that are being developed. And we are now occupying spaces with robots that have a social status, right? They interact with us in a much more social way, like we do with other human beings or even with our pet dog, for that matter. And the question becomes, you know, how do we respond to these devices? What are their social standing? What is their right, if we can use that word, with regards to us and our activities in regards to them? Can we treat them however we want? Or are there limitations on what can and cannot be done in the face of these various objects? I think these are the new moral questions that are on the horizon and the ones that I keep trying to get my students to really grapple with, because I think they're the ones that are going to be, you know, really the important questions for the next several decades.
Yeah, and one other point I'd just like to raise with you at the outset while we're kind of clarifying what phenomena and what kinds of technology we're interested in. You know, there is a stereotypical image of a robot as being, I guess, a quasi-humanoid entity with, you know, a full set of sensors and processors and actuators that are all integrated into one body. And obviously the bomb robot isn't exactly like that, but it is to some extent an integrated unit, which is under the control of a third party or a group of human beings. But this is something I've thought about a lot in relation to governance structures, is that governance structures are kind of like agents as well, but they can be very distributed across an environment and they can be automated. So they can function almost like robots, but they don't have the same sort of integration necessarily of sensors, processors, and actuators. They're more, yeah, it's a more distributed phenomenon. Would you classify that kind of distributed agency structure as a robot or not? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, you know, I would, and I would say that this distributed agency that we see with, for example, the corporation is a really good benchmark and sort of precedent for where things might go, both in moral terms and in legal terms, with regards to our understanding of machines and their place in the world. So, for example, right now, according to international law, Nike, a corporation, is a person, right? In the face of the court, you know, it has the status of personhood. It can be harmed. It can do harm. And that is not a function of the people of the organization, but the organization itself is held accountable for something having gone wrong. So this giant oil spill that we had in the Gulf of Mexico just several years ago is not the fault of the CEO of the corporation, although there's, you know, some culpability there, but it's the fault of the corporation. And the corporation has to stand in front of the court and answer for its actions or inaction, as the case may be. If corporations can be people in this regard, it's very possible that a device like, let's say, Watson, which is under the, you know, umbrella of an organization, of IBM, it would be rather an easy move, I think, to extend the same kind of personhood structure to an autonomous machine that would function very much like a corporation does currently.
Yeah, and I think I definitely want to get back to that idea of distributed agency. But let's kind of circle around on this in a little bit of a longer way. The bomb robot is effectively a tool of human agency. And I mean, for a long time, this is our view of what technology is. Technology is just an instrument for acting on the world, for humans to act on the world. It expands or increases the scope of our agency. So this is a very prevalent view in the philosophy of technology. But I think you would say that it's maybe no longer a correct view, or that it's a misleading view. Could you maybe talk about that?
Sure. So I guess the easiest way to get at this is to sort of look at the way that Heidegger sort of grapples with what's called the instrumental theory of technology. So in The Question Concerning Technology, which is a essay that comes from the 30s originally and doesn't get published until much later in his life, he begins to grapple with the question of technology as tool, which, as you say, has been in place for a very long period of time. It is this idea that, you know, a technological device is just an instrument of human action, and that if something good is done with, for example, a hammer, it's because the carpenter has decided to do something good with the hammer. If something bad is done with the hammer, it's because some nefarious individual has decided to use the same device to do some harm by breaking the window or doing something else. There's an adage in at least American English where we say it's a poor carpenter who blames his tools, right? It's never the tool's fault. It's the carpenter's fault for being good or bad, as the case may be. Heidegger looks at this and says, yeah, that's true. We've talked about our tools in this fashion for a very long period of time. But then he sort of shifts the perspective and he says, you know, tools aren't just neutral things that we decide to use or not use. A tool makes something possible. A tool contextualizes the world in such a way that makes something revealed to us as a possibility. So that the drone is not just a way of killing things, but the drone makes killing different, right? It opens up new opportunities for killing at a distance, which weren't available to us with a spear or even a rifle for that matter. So in the Netherlands, Pieter Paul Verbeek talks about technologies as having a moral context, as creating moral context for us. And this is a very Heideggerian perspective, that our tools shouldn't be seen as simply neutral instruments that we decide to use for good or ill, but rather they open up various possibilities for us, and that the design of the tool is already a moral decision, that the kinds of things we make is already part of a moral infrastructure into which we operate along with the devices that we create.
Could so I just jump in at this point, because this is important in the context of the bomb robot example. So, you know, one of the things that the police said was that, this is going to be paraphrased, so this isn't an exact quote, but it was something like that, we had no other option but to use the bomb robot to take out the suspect. Now, you know, in most conversations traditionally about when the police can use lethal force, it's linked to the immediacy of the threat on their own lives. So, our, you know, classic views of self-defense are framed in terms of, like, what's the immediacy of threat to your own life and to public safety, I guess. But if you're operating through a tool at a distance, through a bomb robot at a distance, I mean, how true is it to say that the threat is an immediate one and that this is the only way to deal with it? It changes the moral context for the decision. And I think that's kind of the point that's being made
correct.
Here.
Yeah. Yes, correct. And then to take it one step further, we also have things that are machines. And Marx makes a very clear distinction between the tool and the machine. In Capital, Marx says, you know, there's tools, which the worker uses, and then there's machines. And machines don't take the place of the tool. Machines take the place of the worker. And they are a replacement for the active subject using the tool. So already with Marx, we have a way of beginning to think about machines as being a much more autonomous kind of entity that is not a neutral object like a tool, but rather starts to occupy the position of the agent or the patient that would employ the tool. And that creates a brand new complication, because then you have devices that we are intentionally designing to take some decision-making away from us and institute that in the world in a way that further complicates this idea of neutrality that we have from our instrumental theory.
Okay, so this is interesting, but so the machine is something that replaces a human actor, replaces the human agent. But I mean, when we talk about the autonomy of machines, I think we have to be a little bit careful, because there's clearly a spectrum of autonomy possibilities. So let me just throw in this example. You could argue, I think, that a landmine is a kind of autonomous machine. You know, somebody steps on the landmine and it explodes. It's not under immediate human control. It's just placed out there in the world. So it's not like the bomb robot, because it's not just a tool of human agency. It's something that operates independently of human agency in the environment. I mean, so is that... Right. That's a very primitive kind of autonomy.
Yeah. So I think we have to look at autonomy as being a spectrum. It's not one thing versus another thing, right? So a landmine, yeah, your average stupid landmine is a kind of autonomous device that we plant in the ground, someone steps on it, it triggers itself without our direct control, and therefore it could be said to be autonomous. I think it's a very low level of autonomy, but it could be, you know, put on the spectrum. Imagine other forms of landmine. Now, I don't want to get into designing weapon systems here, but let's just do a little thought experiment here. Let's say you had a mine that could detect what type of person was stepping on it, that was designed with some sort of sensor to decide whether the weight was sufficient to be a child or whether it was an actual, you know, like automobile. And it would only trigger for heavier objects as opposed to lighter objects, and therefore it wouldn't explode on people, but would only explode on tanks and pickup trucks and dump trucks and things like that. Or imagine a mine that could distinguish between different kinds of human actors, right? That it would be able to have some sort of, you know, vision capabilities and see if it's a soldier in uniform or whether it's a civilian. These are different kinds of autonomy, right? I mean, so we're talking about a range of different kinds of things when we speak of autonomy. And we don't want to lump everything into a very simple, single category when we talk about this, because if we do that, then we miss opportunities for really parsing this in a much more careful way.
Yeah, so we can think of autonomy as this gradient that you have more autonomy the more, I guess, selectivity you have in terms of the decisions and actions you can perform in the world. So the simple landmine has just like one thing it can do in response to weight being pressed on the whatever the trigger mechanism is, whereas your more advanced landmine here has selectivity in terms of how it responds to triggers, it detects different triggers. So it has a larger degree or larger scope of autonomy. And you can imagine autonomy building up then if you have different types of actions you can perform and different decisions that can be made by the machine in that context.
So where this gets really complicated now, or at least interesting, depending on how you want to look at it, is with machine learning algorithms, right? So previously, if you wanted a computer or a robot or an AI to do something, you had to write programming, right? You had to step-by-step tell it what to do in this condition, what to do in that condition. And, you know, if you do programming, you know it's all about if-then statements. If this, then do that. If this, then do that. If not that, then do this, right? So it's all very sort of, you know, formalistic logic. You're setting up a bunch of conditionals. When the condition is met, something happens. When the condition isn't met, then it doesn't happen. In those cases, you know, people have still been able to argue, okay, even when that appears to be somewhat autonomous, there's still a programmer who wrote those instructions. And when something goes wrong, we can always go back to the programmer and say, hey, you're the guy or the woman who set this thing up to do this by writing these sets of instructions, and there's a mistake here and something bad has happened. And that's how we generally trace back autonomy, right, to a human actor in the case of more sophisticated kinds of devices. What machine learning does is really complicate the picture, because in machine learning, if you look at AlphaGo, who beat Lee Sedol recently at the game of Go, or if you look at Tay AI, the engineers are saying to us, well, we don't program these things. We set them up to chug through a whole lot of data, to find the patterns in the data, and then to write their own programming instructions based on the patterns they find. So when you ask the engineers at DeepMind, how did AlphaGo beat Lee Sedol? The engineers answer, we don't know. We don't know what steps were going to be taken by the device in the game of Go that it played against Lee Sedol. It surprised us as much as it surprised everyone else. When you talk to the engineers at Microsoft who had to take Tay offline after she became a racist, their answer, and if you look at the blog post that Microsoft made, they never took responsibility for the racism, right? They said, oh, we're sorry for the unintended consequences, but really, it's the AI's problem. It's not our problem. We did not do anything. The AI has learning built into it. It learned to be a racist. It's really the problem of the people on the internet who taught her to be a racist. So that's where things get, I think, really much more complicated, because we have now devices that we are designing which are somewhat intentionally out of our control, if we can use that terminology.
I mean, but it is interesting in that context where they don't say that they're responsible for it, because they don't program that in this traditional top-down fashion where they specify all the rules, but there's a kind of an attempt to blame society. Isn't there? Yeah. You're the ones providing the data that the machine learns from.
Correct.
And the data is biased, so it's your fault.
I've said to my students, you know, this is a classic form of blame the victim, right? We're the ones that had to deal with the racism. And so what does Microsoft do? It turns around and says, oh, it's your problem.
Yeah, and this is happening in other contexts as well, in terms of like racism that's implicit in various Google algorithms and things like that. Yeah, so let me just throw in one question here about these developments in machine learning are very interesting, and you know, there's a lot of hype around them, I guess, whether we're creating that. We are really creating out truly autonomous and intelligent machines. But anyone who's kind of followed debates in AI for the past half century will know that we've constantly been promised intelligent autonomous machines. Is it really different this time? Is something dramatically different this time around?
So what I find interesting in all of this is that we've often kicked the can into the future. We've said, yes, at some point in the future, we'll have the super intelligent machines that Nick Bostrom is talking about. And at that point, yeah, we'll have to be worried about responsibility. We'll have to be worried about rights. But until that happens, we don't really need to concern ourselves with these things. It's all speculative. We can sit back and develop our devices however we want. And until super intelligence arrives, it's really not our concern. I don't think so. I think superintelligence is, you know, one of those things like the singularity. It might happen, it might not happen, but waiting till that happens, I think, is going to be way too late. I think we're already designing devices that are making decisions without intelligence, that are making decisions based on pattern recognition, and that these decisions have social impact, and that the design and implementation of these devices requires social responsibility. And if we don't begin to grapple with this now in advance of superintelligence, we are going to unleash into the world decision-making systems that escape our own control, or at least escape our own ability to assign responsibility for outcomes. And so I don't think intelligence is where we should put our attention. I think intelligence is sort of a red herring. It's the thing we've, you know, talked about for the longest time under AI. But the fact of the matter is we're creating systems that make decisions that are kind of dumb decisions, right? They're not necessarily generated by, you know, a kind of top-down general intelligence, but more of a kind of pattern recognition bottom-up kind of intelligence, which is much more intuitive and much less about, you know, cognitive thinking processes like we normally consider.
Yeah, so it's really more about like the competence of, or not, maybe not competence is the wrong word, but the capacities of the machine and the extent to which they are under human control. And just like simple example here that a lot of people have used, it's oftentimes things that are very dumb that cause us the biggest problems. You know,
correct.
A virus is a very dumb, quote-unquote, organism, but it can cause huge damage to human society if unleashed. And I guess you could have a similar view of a machine. It could be very dumb, but as long as its capacity and causal power is great, it's something that we need to seriously think about.
So this is that big shift that happened in the last decade, you know, from artificial intelligence or machine intelligence to smart devices, right? We have smart devices. What are smart devices? Well, they're machines that can do one thing really well without having any kind of general cognitive capability whatsoever. And I think what has been both successful for AI but also a bit of a difficulty for ethicists is in shifting from an intelligence-bound understanding of responsibility to a much more distributed form of smart technologies, taking action in the world, not necessarily with the kind of intelligence that we had expected of these devices.
So I want to see if I can express the problem before we look at how we respond to the problem. The problem that's arisen here, or the thing that we need to confront, is that we're creating machines that are competent, that have degrees of autonomy that are relatively unprecedented in history, and our traditional tests for ascribing blame to the consequences of machine actions are ill-suited to this new crop of devices or new crop of machines. So traditional tests for ascribing legal blame, anyway, are typically based on standards like, what were the intentions of the people who created it? Was the damage in question reasonably foreseeable? That kind of thing. And as you pointed out, when Microsoft released Tao into the world, they highlighted the fact that these were all unintended consequences, suggesting that to some extent they might not have been things that are you can't link to the intention of the human designer, and they may not even be things that are reasonably foreseeable by the human designer. So it seems like our traditional legal tests are ill-suited to this new phenomenon. So that's kind of the problem that arises here.
Yeah, I would agree. I would say that the way in which we've assigned both moral agency and moral patiency to the entities in the world has come under increasing strain in the face of these new objects that we're creating, and that we're challenged to begin to think outside the box with regards to our own moral thinking.
Yeah, I appreciate it. I'm unfortunately coming at this from a largely legal background, and I tend to think about blame and responsibility. But as you point out, there's two sides to this. There's the agency responsibility side and the patiency side as well. Okay, so then how do we respond to these developments? What can we do?
So I like to sort of put it on a spectrum. When I explain this to my students, I say, you know, there's a spectrum here. On the one hand, you have individuals who are saying, you know what? Despite the sophistication of the device, despite its complications with learning algorithms, whatever the case is, all these things are still tools and we should treat them as tools. So my colleague Joanna Bryson, who is an AI scientist, has made this argument by saying we should just now, as a society, say to ourselves, say to each other, all robots are slaves. We are creating a brand new race of slaves. They will work for us tirelessly, do our bidding, but we are the ones ultimately responsible. And this is a rather hardline version of the instrumental theory, but it makes sense insofar as it ties into that long history, which says devices, no matter how sophisticated, are tools, and we need to treat them as instruments. And you know, if you go back to Aristotle, what's a slave? A slave is a living tool, right? And so we've had this tradition in our literature for quite some time. On the broader, on the other end of the spectrum, there's a broad spectrum. You have people like Kate Darling, who are arguing, no, it's time to give robots rights, that robots and advanced AIs that are released into the world cannot be considered slaves because we don't want to live in a society that creates slaves. We want to create a much more equitable understanding of our world and the entities in our world. And as a result, we should now begin seriously considering extending rights to devices, to objects, to robots, to machines. In the middle, you have a hybrid position, which is kind of a version of Bruno Latour's actor network theory, which says that all actions taken at this point in time are embedded in a network of interrelationships involving organizations, individual human beings, technologies, you name it. And when it comes to assigning blame or taking responsibility, it's not just one thing that can be held accountable, but it rather needs to be figured out within this network of relationships. And so that's the spectrum we have to deal with. And obviously, each one of these has advantages, but also disadvantages. And figuring out where we're going to locate ourselves with regard to both our moral thinking and our legal decision-making needs to sort of situate itself on the spectrum from slavery on the one hand to full rights on the other hand, and this intermediate kind of thing, which starts to complicate the picture by looking at networks of relationships.
Yeah, so I'm curious to know, where do you think we should fall on this spectrum?
So for myself, if you ask where on the spectrum I stand, I'm leaning far more in the direction of the rights side of the equation than I am on the side of the slavery business. I also see some big complications with this hybrid position, although it sounds really good. Whenever you've got two extremes, you always say, well, the radical middle is the place you want to be, right? Mm. Where you kind of get both at the same time. But there's been complications with this. So, for example, when you start to look at things as being complex networks of responsibility, you can shift responsibility to protect various components of the network. So, for example, during the Nuremberg trials, what did the lower-level Nazi operatives try to do? Shift responsibility up the chain of command to the commanding officers. Or in the Abu Ghraib prison scandal, what did the Bush administration do? They shifted responsibility down the chain of command to the bad apples acting in the field. Or in the case of the financial crisis, when you ask who caused all this money to be lost, the answer is, well, we don't really know. No one did, right? So you can just disperse it in such a way that no one is responsible. And that's not very satisfying from a moral perspective, but also is very frustrating from a legal perspective, where somebody needs to be held accountable, and finding that the accountable individual gets to be increasingly difficult as you distribute that responsibility through the network. So for that reason, I'm leaning more in the direction of granting rights to machines, because I think that is a much more difficult social position, but it's a challenge, I think, that really makes us move in a different direction with regards to our moral and legal thinking, with regards to the other things in the world that we exist with. And really, for myself, this comes out of my own interactions with animal rights and also with environmental ethics, which were the big 20th century innovations in moral thinking, where we extended moral standing to things like the environment, to things like my pet dog. And I think robots could possibly situate themselves in a very similar situation in the 21st century.
So I want to talk a little bit about why you prefer this picture, but let me just push back for a moment against the critique of the hybridization model. So I find myself sympathetic to that idea, insofar as I think it might be more true to reality that responsibility is distributed across these networks. And actually, one of the arguments that I'm interested in pursuing is not like, well, how can we preserve traditional theories of rights and responsibilities in the new technological age, but to what extent the new developments in technology basically tend to dissolve or undermine a lot of our traditional moral conceptions. So, I mean, one example here, which I'm particularly interested in, is the responsibility in criminal law contexts or in legal contexts, where the traditional views are much tied to concepts of retribution and blameworthiness and moral guilt. I'm not necessarily convinced that those ideas are all that valuable socially. And I think one of the things that the growth of what I call a machine-mediated agency in the world, it tends to maybe undermine the grounds or the rationale for that retributivist guilt-based view. And this might be a good thing, that if we embrace this kind of hybridization, we can get rid of maybe unwelcome moral concepts and ideas. What do you think of that?
So, yeah, this is a good question. One of the problems in this whole arena is when you start to talk about it only in terms of responsibility, you very quickly move in the direction of how do you punish a robot, right? Yeah. If a robot does something wrong, we hold it accountable. What do we do in terms of retribution to punish the robot? What would harm a robot? Incarceration, lack of input? I mean, what is possible there? That is true. But I also think that's a very limited view of moral consideration because it only looks at agency.
Okay.
And I think agency, yeah, it's important. But I also think patience is going to be the thing that trumps the agency issue here, because these robots are going to occupy a space in our world, right? They're going to be in our home. They're going to be in our workplace. We are going to have to socially respond to them. And the question becomes, how do we respond? How do we respond in the face of something that's not human? And traditionally, in moral philosophy, our response to the other, if you want to put it that way, has never been really very good, right? I mean, what did Columbus do when he got here and he found a bunch of people who didn't look like him? Well, pretty much they destroyed entire civilizations, right? I mean, it was genocide. For the longest period of time, women were not considered full moral and legal beings, right? They were considered to be somehow property belonging to the head of the household, who was always male. What do we do with the robot? Is the robot going to be just another piece of property? Or do we need to have a much more sophisticated way of understanding the social standing and position of these things, which are much more capable than our pens, pencils, staplers, and computers? That's the real challenge, I think. I think the responsibility thing is an important question having to do with, decision-making in the world. But I also think the patience part can't be lost in this process. And most of my work is on the patience side, mainly because I don't see anybody talking about it. This is the sort of hope of my research, is that I can bring this to the conversation to help us begin to think at least about these kinds of consequences. Just to put it in very simple terms, use a simple example. If you have a healthcare robot taking care of your, mother or father as they become aged, and a new model of that robot is available, do you just trash the old robot for the new robot? Can you just throw it away like you do your refrigerator? Some people say yes, some people say no. But if you look at what's actually happening in our relationships with robots, it's much more complicated. So, for example, the soldiers in Iraq that were using robots to do diffusings of bombs in the field, they became very attached to these individual robots. And when the robot was destroyed because it triggered the bomb or something, they insisted on getting that exact robot back. They didn't want a replacement. They wanted that particular robot. And they wrote letters to the iRobot Corporation saying, you know, our robot, and they gave it a name, right? They gave it a proper name just like we do our pets, was destroyed in this bomb diffusion. Can you please repair him and send him back to us? They had pronouns, right? Him, her. We personalize these things in ways that make it very difficult for us to just dispose of them like another object. And that's what really interests me.
Yeah, so I take the correction, and I apologize for
No,
looking at it from the responsibility side, but yet the patiency side is important. But then here is a concern I have about patiency in the context of robots and other things too, other legal persons or entities. I think that our tendency to treat something as a moral patient is going to be susceptible to all sorts of factors that might be irrelevant. So I think like our attachment to the robot may be largely attributable to how we analogize it to other things that we care about. So I think the stuff on diffusal robots, I don't know if that's coming from Julie Carpenter's work, because that's the work that I'm familiar with, that people treat these bomb disposal robots as kind of akin to pets. That was one of her arguments.
Right.
They view them as akin to pets. And if you have the worker and the care robot in the home, you'll tend to analogize that to the kindly healthcare provider or nurse, because it takes on a certain shape or characteristic of a human being. It's a humanoid form. But when you have like distributed agency and distributed entities, I think we're much less prone to have the kind of moral sympathy towards that type of agent. And I'm thinking here like of corporations, for example. So corporations have long been artificial legal persons and been granted legal rights and responsibilities. But I don't know if people in general view them as objects of moral concern, as moral patients. I don't know.
Right. So I would say maybe not a corporation, but definitely a sports team.
Okay, yeah.
So right? People really care about their sports teams, even though they are artificial entities.
Yeah, so it depends on, I guess, the context and how they encounter and how they relate to the corporation or the corporate entity, whatever it happens to be.
So, I mean, for example, look at Apple. I mean, people have a very positive interaction with Apple and a very sort of, you know, people are Apple fans, right? Say something bad against Apple and they will correct you because they've invested in that particular relationship. You know, there are corporations that through clever marketing or whatever have positioned themselves in such a way as to build a following where people are able to treat them less like a entity that just a function, but more like a good friend.
Yeah, but this is where I worry about it though, because it's prone to a kind of manipulation of your emotional response to the entity. So, I mean, in the case of robots, you know, there has been a good deal of research that you're possibly more familiar with it than I am on. You know, if you give the robot a humanoid voice, a nice kind of pleasant sounding voice, people will be more susceptible to its charms. And in the context of Apple, many people would argue that they're creating a kind of false family or fake kinship there in order to get to extract money from people. And maybe it's not like such a valuable relationship or a phenomenon.
So I would completely agree with you that this is open to incredible manipulation. And people are utilizing this in all kinds of ways. If you look at what is being done in the work of like Cynthia Brazil, who is making the social robots. I mean, everything from Kismet to Jibo are intentionally designed to really like draw on our human emotions, right? And to pull us in through design to make us cathect with these things that are just objects. That's an intentional decision on their part. And you could say they are manipulating us. On the other hand, I don't want to look in the face of an Iraq soldier. I had one in my classroom recently and say to him, you're wrong for putting all that faith in your robot.
Yeah, no, that's fair enough. I mean, I think this is a complicated question, but I do want to maybe put a line under this question of robot rights and responsibilities to talk about something else, which is very closely related when we talk about the hybridization, I guess, between human agencies and machine agencies or patients as well, human patients and machine patients, which is cyborgification.
Right.
When we think about robots, we usually think of them as entities that are distinct from human beings, that the technology is something that's distinct from a human. It could be a tool, or else it could be an autonomous agent. There's also an interesting phenomenon where the contemporary era where there's more of a blurring of the boundaries between man and machine. And this is an idea that's encapsulated in the word cyborg and the belief among many people that we are, perhaps always were, cyborgs. So I want to maybe explore this idea and the consequences it has for particularly political theory and the things that, that we value. Just first, though, I wanted to ask you about the origins of the word cyborg, because it has an interesting origin, and you've written about it in the past. So could you explain the origin of the word cyborg?
Yeah, so it comes from an article written in the 1960s by Manfred Klein and Nathan Kleins, who were worrying about manned spaceflight, basically. And so they published their article in a journal called Astronautics. And the problem with manned spaceflight is that you've got to take with the astronaut everything necessary to sustain him or her in the void of space. And that's a weight problem. And launch vehicles are all about reducing weight in order to maximize efficiency to get into orbit with, you know, the least amount of effort. And so Kleins and Klein theorized that instead of taking oxygen with you and food with you and an environment with heat in it, you could just modify the human body to live in space. Why not, you know, change us for the environment as opposed to taking our environment with us into the depths of the ocean or into the heights of outer space? So it was this idea of modifying the human organism with all kinds of implants, whether it be pharmaceutical with drugs, whether it be mechanical with various prostheses, whatever the case is, but it would be a way of modifying the human organism with some kind of cybernetic implant of some sort or another. And so they took the word cybernetic and organism, chopped them up a little bit, jammed them together, and created the word cyborg.
Right. So what do we understand by the word cyborg nowadays? How do you understand the term when you use it?
Right. So the term cyborg really gets used in a lot of different ways by a lot of different interest groups who come from, I think, not necessarily the same place. So I think the most obvious example is that you have in the world right now, very literally speaking, cyborgs. You have people who have pacemakers. You have people with prosthetic arms. You have people with prosthetic legs. And these are, given Kleins and Klein's definition of the cyborg, very literal examples of cyborgs. They are human organisms that have been augmented with pieces of technology, whether it be the pacemaker to regulate the heart's rhythm, or whether it be a, you know, neurologically controlled prosthetic arm that replaces a lost limb from an accident.
I just want to be clear here, though, about this idea of the cyborg, the literal cyborg. What makes them a literal cyborg?
We call it literal only because it is very much in line with the original definition provided by Kleins and Klein. So it's very literally what Kleins and Klein had in mind with their article back in the 60s.
Okay, but here's a trivial example. If I wear rollerblades, am I a cyborg in that case? I'm using technology to change the way that I interact with the environment?
Some would say that is the case, but if you look at Kleins and Klein's way of describing the cyborg, it has to become an integrated homeostatic system.
Yeah, okay.
So you can take the rollerblades off.
So this is something that's integrated into our biological system, right?
Yeah. Correct. So you don't wake up in the morning and put the pacemaker in your chest. It's already there. Right? Or the individual who has the device that doses insulin that is under their skin. That's not something they have to take out and put in every day. It's part of their actual organism, right? So Kleins and Klein, I think, distinguish between the technologies we take on and off, like glasses, and the technologies that are integrated into our organism. And it's the latter that would be more of the cyborg.
What about the psychopharmacologically active substances? I mean, if I drink a cup of coffee, that doesn't fit with that definition then?
But what does fit with that definition and the example that Kleins and Klein use is the example of reprogramming your immune system with some kind of vaccination.
Okay.
So the way that vaccination works is that you introduce the disease agent into the body in order to force the body's mechanisms to build the antibodies against the infection, right? So you're, in effect, reprogramming the body to develop the antibodies before you get the disease.
So in that sense, most people are cyborgs then.
Yeah. I mean, so N. Catherine Hales, who wrote the book How We Became Posthuman, argues that because of this kind of development in contemporary society, it's hard to find someone who is purely human.
Yeah. So, but I mean, this is literal cyborgs in line with the original definition of cyborg in Kleins and Klein. But there are other ways of thinking about the cyborg.
Correct. So another way of thinking about it is with what's this development called transhumanism, which sort of looks at the way in which we can use our technologies to improve human existence. So Ray Kurzweil, I think, is a big figure in this field, right? Talking about ways of taking drugs to live as long as you possibly can, ways of developing new technologies that can be implanted in the body to replace failing organs. So the transhumanist movement is all about mobilizing our technological advancement to enhance human life, mainly to make us live longer. That seems to be the thing they're all really concerned with, but also make us smarter and other things like that. And, you know, there's a lot of debate about this, and there's some contentious, you know, voices in the transhumanist movement. But in general, it's you know, taking this idea of literal cyborg and turning it into a very willful, I'm going to modify my body. I'm going to, you know, go there and start changing my body for the betterment of my existence. So an individual who does a lot of like self-research on this is Kevin Warrick, right? I mean, he's a guy who is implanting things in his body to try and change the way it functions, not because he needs it, but because he wants to experiment on himself with regards to improving his own existence. And Kurzweil does the same. He's very much involved with smart drugs and things like this to try and live longer. So that's a sort of a second form of cyborg. It's a much more positive understanding of cyborg than I think you get in the cinematic literature, right? Where the cyborg is always this horrible creature from outer space coming to kill us. This is a much more, you know, way of looking at the cyborg as improving human life as opposed to denigrating human life.
Yeah. And the kind of biohacking community in general, I think, has that kind of positively valenced view of the cyborg. But there are, again, there are other ways of thinking about cyborg too in a more metaphorical, less technical sense. So could you outline those other ways of thinking about cyborgification?
So this is the sort of third step in the literature, right? This comes mainly through Donna Haraway, who single-handedly resurrected the word cyborg. In other words, Kleins and Klein invent this word. They put it out there. It kind of like disappears in the 80s, right? It just sort of recedes from view and doesn't really get a lot of press. And then Donna Haraway in, you know, the mid-80s writes the Cyborg Manifesto, which is a feminist manifesto, and sort of resurrects this idea of the cyborg as a way of contextualizing a kind of new techno-feminism and enabling a new way of thinking about technologies and bodies and our relationship to the world. And it's incredibly successful because it launches what you call this sort of metaphoric way of thinking about the cyborg. So in Haraway's mind, the cyborg is not about prostheses. It's not about transhumanism. It's not about any of that stuff we normally think about when we talk about cyborg. For her, the cyborg is a concept that disturbs the humanist assumptions about our exceptionalism in the world. She says a cyborg exists when you have two boundary breakdowns, the boundary between the human and the animal and the boundary between the human and the machine. And she says at this point in time, the difference between us and the animals is almost, you know, gone, right? Beginning with Darwin, up through a lot of the work being done with language and tool use, it turns out that we're part of a spectrum with the animals and not something separate from the animals. She says the same with machines. Beginning with Norbert Wiener and the cybernetics movement that he initiated and into sort of information theory and everything else, we're now all information systems. And as a result, the boundary between the human and the machine is also eroding. And she says this is where the cyborg occurs. It occurs at this point of erosion. Now for her, this is an empowerment. This is not something that we should look at as being somehow degrading the human, but rather opening up new ways of recognizing our embeddedness in a much more complex reality. And she thinks that this is the way to empower feminists to escape the long tradition of humanism, which has been very detrimental to women, to people of color, to all kinds of others. And as a result, she writes the Cyborg Manifesto, not as a manifesto for technology necessarily, but as a manifesto for thinking beyond the limitations of sort of Western metaphysical thinking.
Yes, I mean, this is quite important, but let me just focus on Haraway's idea so that I'm clear about it. For Haraway, the dissolution of these boundaries is not really induced by technology per se. It's more induced by the frameworks that we use to understand ourselves and our relationship to the world. So in one context, it's evolutionary theory, which is changing how we understand the relationship between humans and animals. And in the other context, It is information theory or cybernetics theory that's changing how we view humans. We just view them as information processing systems, and hence on a continuum with all other kinds of machines. So it's a shift in the, you know, the mental or cognitive frameworks that we use to approach these phenomena. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's very correct. In fact, if you want to find a place where cyborgification really happens, it's with the discovery of DNA.
Yeah. Okay.
So what DNA shows us is that, one, we're not very different from our closest ape relative, which is the chimpanzee. We're, you know, 97.2% chimpanzee, genetically speaking. And that what DNA is a program that runs on an information processing device that happens to be organic.
Yeah, and people like Richard Dawkins have been pushing this for a very long time, that modern biology is effectively just a type of information theory. Now, that said, although it's driven by these cognitive frameworks, these theoretical understandings of the world, it is also something that can, those understandings can clearly be affected by technological changes as well. So, you know, our entire conversation in the first part of this podcast about robots and robot rights and responsibilities and how we need to think about these things because of the developments in technology, those developments also affect, I think, our theoretical understanding of the world and our relationship to it. So they are also, so the technology here is driving the revision of how we think about these boundaries. Would that be fair?
I think it's fair. Excuse me for one second.
That's all right. That's a great ringtone, by the way.
Yeah, thanks. My son selected that for me. So in terms of what drives what, I think it's a little more complicated. I think it's okay. Much more of a, you know, kind of everything driving everything else simultaneously. But I do think that when you look at this, that these changes that Haraway talks about have led to incredible, you know, sort of progressive movements with regards to moral thinking or even legal thinking. So you wouldn't have the animal rights movement in the 1970s. If we hadn't dissolved the boundary between the human and the animal, so that we could now see the animal not as being a resource that we can use for our own food and our own natural resources, but rather as a kind of kinship, right, where we need to be respectful of animal life. The same with what has happened with, you know, robots and AI, where we start to see, you know, relationships between soldiers and robots in the field, which, you know, start to open up some new possibilities for thinking about, you know, moral respect or at least some sort of, you know, kinship that is much more close than we get with the average tool understanding of our technologies. So I think, yeah, I think this opens up all kinds of new moral possibilities, but also legal possibilities.
Okay, there are two directions I want to go in here, but they're kind of opposite or directions. I want to take a brief detour into talking about the Borg in Star Trek. So,
yeah,
I
mean, good.
This is something that you've written about, and actually this is one of the things I've written about your work as well. You in one of your papers about it, I think it's Resistance is Futile, Are We Already Borg or something along those lines, or maybe that's the title I gave to it. I can't remember the title of the paper, but you use Haraway's idea to make the argument that we are effectively Borg in the sense in which the term Borg is used in Star Trek. Now, in Star Trek, the Borg are this alien entity. They're not a species or they're not a species or type of alien like the Klingon or whatever in Star Trek. They're a technological entity in which humanoid life forms are turned into technical cyborgs, I guess. They're, you know, prosthetics are grafted onto them, and they've got all these implants sticking out of them, so they're technical cyborgs in that sense. But they're also then co-opted into this hive mind. And in the hive mind, the sense of individuality and the boundary between self and other breaks down. And this is something that I'm interested in as well. So Haraway talks about the boundary between human and animal and human and machine. But I think there's another important boundary, which is the boundary between self and other, and that this is something that is also kind of threatened and dissolved, maybe primarily by technologically induced changes. So actually, you talked about the work of Kevin Warwick.
Right.
It seems to me like the kind of brain implants and brain-to-brain communication devices that he wants to create And also the surveillance society that we've created, all of these things serve to some extent to dissolve boundaries between self and other. And I think that's another kind of third important dimension to this, and that we may be creating like Borg-like societies, both in the sense that we become cyborgs in a technical and metaphorical or conceptual sense, as outlined in Haraway's work and your own work, but also in this sense that we become less individual. I wonder what you think about that idea.
So I would respond to it by saying that individualism is a modernist invention, right? I mean, we created the idea of individualism through Descartes' cogito ergo sum, which then created a difference between the self who knows itself and all the others out there in the world who I can't be sure about. And so what we're seeing with a lot of this kind of cyborg effort is pushing back from a postmodern perspective against that modernist tradition and telling us, in effect, that individualism may have already been a kind of humanist mythology. It may have been a story we told ourselves about ourselves that never was really true, but rather was a kind of ideology that we mobilized. The other thing I tell my students is, you know, the Borg is not the future, right? Science fiction is never about the future. Science fiction, as Cory Doctorow tells us, is about current anxieties projected on the stage or the screen of the future. So where's the hive mind right now? It's Facebook, right? I mean, we open ourselves up to the world and share our most intimate ideas with everyone, almost without regards for, you know, any sort of restraint. And as a result, you know, we can't really complain about loss of privacy because we're the ones who are giving the privacy away. We've told Facebook, take it all, right? Because you're going to give me the free service, I will give you access to everything. So I think this issue of individual, self, other, it's a complicated issue insofar as it has a history and insofar as it isn't a future catastrophe, but rather is a current evolutionary concept that we have to grapple with, I think, with the technologies we currently have, as opposed to projecting it on the Borg and saying, oh, you know, that's going to happen in the future.
Yeah, so I agree with that. And my point really about the individualism and the boundary between self and other, it's just that, this is also an ideological creation, the ideology of individualism, just as much as humanism is an ideological creation. And maybe they're expressions of the same kind of early modern tradition.
So what I would just say is, you know, because we know that, we shouldn't look at those things as somehow being natural and therefore being lost. Because what's being lost is something that was fabricated.
Okay.
And you have to have a much more sophisticated way of looking at this historical development and what it means for us. It isn't something we should just look at and frown and say, oh, I've lost my individualism. That's a very, you know, sort of basic way of looking at it. I think it's much more interesting. And we have to look at it in the historical context, understand what's being lost, what's being gained, why we think something is being lost, and what that tells us about our own history.
So I agree with that to an extent in that it is it's an invention, and this means that we shouldn't kind of view it as a natural phenomenon and necessarily a loss. That said, it is, I think, true to say that a lot of our contemporary value system is based on these humanist and individualist ideals.
And, oh, yeah.
And, you know, this is what happens in Star Trek as well. The Borg pose are deemed to pose a huge threat to the value system of the Federation. I think you mentioned this in your paper that, you know, Captain Picard in The Next Generation kind of embodies Enlightenment values, humanist values, in the individualistic ethos. And that's why it's such an assault or such an offense to us when we see him being assimilated into the Borg.
Right. So, I mean, there's one of two responses here, right? You can respond the way the Federation responds. How does the Federation respond to the Borg threat? They fire back. They dig their heels in. They say, our civilization is based on individualism. We are going to destroy you because you want to destroy us. The other response is to look in the face of the Borg and say, yeah, you got some good questions there. Maybe we should look at ourselves and ask where our values come from. Maybe we should look at ourselves and ask what our values cause us to do or not do, as the case may be. And maybe we should re-examine what we do from this point forward.
So, yeah, I mean, looking at these things in historical perspective is important, and there's two books I wanted to mention. I don't know if you're familiar with either of them. One is by Ian Morris, which is Foragers, Farmers, and Fossil Fuels, which is about how value systems have changed over time in response to certain technological developments. It's a very Marxist thesis, except it's defended with different kinds of evidence and ideas that Marx would defend it with. And he talks about the transition from foraging-based societies to farming and fossil fuel societies. And he also speculates quite a bit towards the end about transhumanist or cyborg societies and what kind of value systems they might have. And one of these things that he looks at is the attitude towards violence and also towards equality and distinctions between individuals and self and other. Another book is called The Invention of the Individual by Larry Seiden, I think Seidentrop, which is about how the individualist theory or ideology developed over time. One of the things he points back to historically in ancient Greek societies, maybe like pre-classical Greek of Plato and Aristotle, before then, the basic unit in society was viewed as the family, and then it became the polis or the city. Nowadays, it's the individual. What will be the new basic unit of society, if there is one, in the kind of cyborg future or the new era that's being inaugurated through technology? I don't know if you have any thoughts on that, but I think placing it in historical context at least encourages us to think that there will be some new entity.
Yeah, so let me try and pull this down to a very sort of basic level, because I mean, I think this can spin out in a lot of different directions, but it's a really good question. In a way, even if we took a modernist view of ourselves as individuals, you can sort of see right now how we've become more hybridized with our technologies that changes how we think about individualism. So, for example, now we are not just individual human beings. We are individual human beings with a smartphone. And if you take our smartphone away, most of us can't function. We externalize a lot of our brain into our handheld device. And as a result, we're operating as a kind of assemblage that involves not just the smartphone, but the cloud the smartphone is connected to. So a really good example of this is when you're out with friends and someone has a question, what was that name of that TV show where this guy did this or did that? Immediately, the phones come out, you look it up, you download the information from the cloud, and you can articulate the name of the television show for everyone, and there's not even a moment's hesitation, right? This is becoming more and more common, this idea that we're, you know, connected to this network of information that we can really draw down on in order to inform our world and make decisions and whatever. This is different, right? This is a very different way of interacting as a entity in the world, which makes us all part of a much larger assemblage. So I think this is the kind of thing we're starting to grapple with.
Yeah, no, and I think that's a useful way of framing it. I mean, it's very much linked into these ideas of the extended mind. But I mean, the extended mind is essentially still an individualistic ethos or an individualistic idea. It's that, you know, my mind extends into the world around me, and then you treat that kind of loop or hybrid being as an individual. I wonder if there's something more radical and more kind of alternative possibility as well through the new technological human assemblages that are being created.
Yeah, I definitely think so. I think it involves an entire reconceptualization of ourselves within the world, right? I mean, sort of breaking with the Cartesian tradition. This is not going to be an easy thing. You have a lot of writers sort of pushing against this boundary, but doing so in such a way that, you know, oftentimes has very reactionary outcomes. And what we need to begin puzzling through and working through individually, but also together, is, you know, who are we now? What are we becoming at this particular point in time? I don't think we have an answer to that question. I don't think we have a good answer to that question. And I think going backwards to what we've always known is the wrong direction. But what we move towards, I don't think we know what that is just yet.
Yeah, I think that's a fair comment. But just to say that this is really getting into the heart of what this project, as I originally conceived it, was supposed to be about. There's supposed to be really three main components to it. One was to think about the ways in which we are being changed by technology, the way in which society is being changed by it. Then to articulate the ways in which these changes might threaten traditional value systems, particularly humanist and Enlightenment value systems, and then also to think about, well, what could the transition be? What could the new transformative set of values be? But as you say, it's difficult to think about those things because we often tie it back into our familiar models. And that's also why we often see these technological developments as something threatening that might cause or might result in a loss of something.
Right. So this is why I believe we see so much cinema, in science fiction especially, that is about this question. Because we're really trying to think through this. And science fiction is always about thinking about the current anxiety. And the current anxiety is trying to figure out our place in the world as we are threatened by all kinds of things. Animals on the one hand, machines on the other hand. But we see transformation on the horizon. And science fiction is one place I think we see this played out. Now, oftentimes it ends by going backwards, right? Oftentimes it ends with a kind of reactionary recuperation of the past. But I think we can look at science fiction, things like the Borg, things like RoboCop, things like Blade Runner, as places where this thought is externalized, where we're actually working through these things, both individually, in the case of a novel written by Philip K. Dick, or collectively in the form of the Blade Runner movie, which brings a lot more different players involved in creating that kind of vision. But I think that's where we find a lot of it really happening and a lot of it. In fact, Haraway even says this. She says, science fiction is theory for cyborgs.
Yeah, I know you reminded me that I need to go and watch RoboCop and Blade Runner and Terminator and all these things again. And maybe I'll do that over the weekend. I think perhaps we might leave it there because it's a good place to end. But
okay.
The role of science fiction in reflecting on present anxieties. So yeah, I just would recommend to everybody who's listening to this to check out your work. I'll provide links to your webpage and your papers in the post that accompanies this podcast. Yeah, I'd just like to thank you for joining me for this conversation.
Yeah, no problem. It was really fun. It was good.